Now will you take your Bible tonight, please, and turn to Psalm 22. Psalm 22, and I want to read for you verses 14 through 18. Tonight we want to take a look at Calvary through the eyes of the crucified one. Psalm 22, verses 14 through 18. We read these words. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaveth to my jaws. And thou hast brought me into the dust of death. For dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I may count all my bones. They look and they stare upon me. They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture. This psalm is what we call a messianic psalm. Now, a messianic psalm is simply a psalm that makes a prediction about the Messiah, who was Jesus Christ, that was to come. We know this is a messianic psalm because in John's Gospel, chapter 19, verses 23 and 24, we are told that when the Roman soldiers took the clothes of Jesus and divided them equally among themselves, and then took his coat and gambled over it to determine who would receive it, that they did that in order that a passage of Scripture in the Old Testament might be fulfilled. And that passage of Scripture was Psalm 22, verse 18, where we read, they part my garments among them and cast lots for my vesture. Now, since this verse is a prediction of what happened to Jesus, the personal pronouns my in this verse must refer to Jesus Christ. Otherwise, this verse cannot be a prediction of what happened to Jesus, as recorded for us in John's Gospel, chapter 19, verses 23 and 24. This verse, then, is a definite prediction of something that would happen to Jesus. Now, when you look at the preceding verses and the following verses, you find that the personal pronouns there refer to the same persons to whom the personal pronouns in verse 18 refer. Consequently, this entire psalm is a messianic psalm. It makes a prediction about the Messiah, who was Jesus Christ. But what does it predict about Jesus? What it predicts about Jesus is the words that he was going to utter just prior to his death. I want you to think back in time. I want you to remember the day of the crucifixion. It was 9 o'clock in the morning, and the Roman soldiers took Jesus, the Son of God, and they nailed him to an old rugged cross. And he was suspended between heaven and earth. The crowds milled around, and as they were there, they mocked the Son of God. They poked fun at him. They jeered at him. And then 12 o'clock noon came. Suddenly, darkness settled down upon the face of the earth. Time continued to go by. 1 o'clock came. 2 o'clock came. And then as that 3 o'clock hour approached, suddenly from the midst of that awful darkness, there came a loud cry, my God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Those words constituted the foresaying of Jesus on Calvary's cross. And if you look at verse 1 of this psalm, you'll find those words. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Jesus uttered those words out loud so that all around him could hear. And then after he uttered those words out loud, he continued to talk to his father, but he didn't speak out loud so that those around him could hear. He talked to the Father the way you and I frequently pray, when we use real words, but if someone were standing beside us, they wouldn't hear a word that we said because we weren't talking out loud. Yet we were praying real words to the Lord. And Jesus continued to pray until he came down to verse 15. And then notice verse 15, he said in the middle of that verse, "And my tongue cleaveth to my jaws." And right there he paused in talking to the Father. And he uttered the fifth saying on the cross. He said, "I thirst." He uttered those words out loud so that those around him could hear. And then after he uttered those words, he continued to talk to the Father, but not out loud so that those around him could hear, but nevertheless saying real words. And then when he finished the rest of this psalm, he uttered the sixth saying on the cross. When he said, "It is finished. That is the work of salvation which I have come to accomplish for those who would believe in me is done. Everything necessary for it has been accomplished." What a triumphant cry that was. And then right after he uttered that cry came the seventh saying, when he said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." And there on Calvary's cross, in that human nature which Jesus had taken unto himself, he died. Thus, as we read the words of Psalm 22, we get a glimpse of Calvary, unlike any other glimpse of Calvary that you have recorded in the Word of God. You are not seeing the crucifixion through the eyes of a bystander as he stands there and watches what takes place. But rather, as you read the psalm, you are looking at Calvary through the eyes of the crucified one. You are, as it were, going into the very heart, into the very mind of Jesus Christ. And you are discovering what he felt as he describes it as he hung on that cross. You are seeing what thoughts went through his mind as he hung there on that cross. What he experienced as he describes it as he hung there on Calvary's old rugged cross. You and I, as we read the psalm, are looking at Calvary through the eyes of the crucified one. And as we do it tonight, there are two things that I want you to see with me. The first thing I want you to notice is the description of the suffering of the crucified one. Now, we have this given to us in verses 14 through 18 that I read to you. And I want you to notice what Jesus suffered as he himself describes it for us. The first thing that he mentioned was this. He said that he was utterly helpless. Now look at the first part of verse 14. He said, "I am poured out like water." That means that in his human nature, which he had taken to himself, he was utterly helpless. And as he hung there on Calvary's cross, he was utterly helpless. Humanly speaking, there was no way that he could escape the crucifixion that he was experiencing. But there's something that you and I need to remember. And that is this, that the one hanging on that cross was not only fully man, but he was fully God as well. And as fully God, he could have come down from that cross anytime he wished. As that crowd gathered around and mocked at him and looked up at him and said, "Now, if you are really the Son of God, come down and then we'll believe you." Jesus could have looked at him. He could have come down from that cross and said, "Now, here I am. You said you would believe if I come down. Here I am. Now will you believe?" He could have done that, but he didn't. As he hung there on that cross, he could have called more than 12 legions of angels. A legion consists of anywhere from 3 to 6,000. He could have called anywhere from over 36 to over 72,000 angels, and they would have come and delivered him just like that. He told Peter when he tried to defend him when he was arrested after Judas had betrayed him, "Put up your sword, Peter. If I wanted to, I could call more than 12 legions of angels." If he could have done it then, he could have done it when he was on the cross. But he didn't do it. As he hung there on that cross and saw his enemies all about him, he could have spoken one word, and they would have all died right there on the spot. That's what's going to happen when Jesus comes again. His enemies will all be gathered together in a great confederation against him. And he'll speak one word, and with the word of his mouth, they'll all be killed. The ground will be littered with their corpses, and the fowl of the air will come. And they will eat the flesh off their bodies. If he is able to do it when he comes the second time, he was able to do it at Calvary, but he didn't do it. Why didn't he do it? Why didn't he come down from that cross? I'll tell you why. It was because of his love for you. It was because of his love for me. It was his love for us that held him to that cross. For he knew that unless he suffered what he was going through, that there would be no way that you and I could be saved from eternal punishment and hell. And so as he talks to his Father, he says, "Father, I'm utterly helpless in my human nature. I'm poured out like water." And then notice the second thing he mentions. He says that he was suffering extreme physical pain. Look at the next part of verse 14. He says, "And all my bones are out of joint." Now that phrase, "are out of joint," comes from a Hebrew word which means to be separated or divided. And when it speaks of his bones, it means that all of his bones were loosened at the joints. All of his bones were separated from one another. Now, as Jesus hung on that cross, certainly some of his bones were separated from one another. But he doesn't mean to say here that every single bone in his body was literally separated from one another. That's not what he means. What he is saying is, "I feel like all of my bones are out of joint." Do you know the pain that comes with just one bone being out of joint? Have you ever had a bone out of joint? Do you know the pain that you experience when you have such a thing? Now you take that pain and multiply it by the pain a person would experience if every single bone in his body were out of joint. And then you'll begin to see the kind of pain that Jesus was experiencing. It was blinding pain. It was pain that was so great that he could scarcely see. It was pain that was unbearable, and yet he had to bear it. It was pain that stabbed him through like a knife, but he had to endure it. And so he looks to his Father, and he says, "Father, I just feel like all my bones are out of joint. I'm suffering extreme physical pain." And then notice the next thing he mentions. He says that his courage was gone. Look at the next part of verse 14. "My heart is like wax. It is melted within me," or more literally, "in the midst of my bowels." Now the word "heart" that is used here refers to courage. It has reference to the courage of a person. Hold your finger there just for a moment and turn over to Joshua chapter 2. And look at verse 11. Here Rahab is talking to the two spies whom she had hidden on the roof of her house there in Jericho. And as she talked to them, she tells them about how the people in Jericho have heard about how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea when the children of Israel came out of Egypt. And how the children of Israel have utterly destroyed these two Amorite kings, Og and Sihon, across the Jordan River. And she says in verse 11 that as soon as we, that is Rahab and the others in Jericho, had heard of these things, that is how the Lord dried up the Red Sea when He delivered the people of Israel from Egypt, and how the children of Israel utterly destroyed those two powerful Amorite kings, Og and Sihon, across the Jordan River. She says, as soon as we heard of these things, now watch it, our hearts did melt. What does that mean? It means that their courage melted away. Our hearts did melt. Neither did there remain any more courage in any man. There it spells it out for you. Neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. She said, when we here at Jericho heard what the Lord did for you when He brought you out of Egypt, how He dried up the water of the Red Sea, and how you defeated those two Amorite kings, our courage just melted away. It just vanished altogether. And the word heart is used to refer to courage. We use it that way sometimes today. We'll say, take heart. What do we mean? We mean take courage. Now He says, my heart, my courage is like wax. It is melted within me, or in the midst of my bowels, inside of me. Remember one time my wife and I were invited to the home of a couple, and we were eating dinner by candlelight. It was one of those dinners that never seemed to end. You know how it is. You sit down, you eat your dinner, and then you stay there, and you fellowship, and you nibble, and you fellowship, and you nibble, and you fellowship, and you nibble. Well, it went on that way for a long time. Those candles were a fair size when we started to eat, but we sat there almost the entire evening. And by the time we got ready to leave, there wasn't much left of those candles. Now, if those candles had continued to burn, they were made of wax, and if they had continued to burn, they would have completely vanished. They would have completely disappeared. And that's what Jesus is saying when He says, my heart is like wax. It is melted away within me. My courage is melted away. My courage is gone. And you can understand that when you see Jesus hanging there on Calvary's cross. As He looked out there and He saw His enemies, they reminded Him of those bulls of Bashan. Look back at verse 12. He says, many bulls have compassed me. Strong bulls of Bashan have beset me. He's talking about those bulls that roamed that rich, fertile pasture land of Bashan that was just east of the Sea of Galilee and that extended northward. And if there's one thing that marked those bulls, it was their fierceness. They were as fierce as they could be. And what they would do was to get a victim, and they would completely encircle that victim so as to cut off any possibility of escape. And then those bulls would put their heads down, and they would charge that victim and gore that victim through with their horns. And Jesus, as He hung there on the cross, looked out at the enemies around Him. And as He looked out at the enemies around Him and saw how fierce they were and how they had cut off any possibility of His escape, humanly speaking, He says, Father, my courage is gone. It's just melted away. It's vanished. It's disappeared. My courage, humanly speaking, is gone. But not only that, as He looked out there at His enemies, they reminded Him of another animal. Look at that in verse 13. They, referring to His enemies, gaped upon me with their mouths. Literally in the Hebrew it says, they opened upon me their mouth like a ravening and roaring lion, or more literally, like a lion which is ravening, that is tearing and roaring. What a picture this is. Here's a lion that's hungry. The lion is roaring, expressing its hunger. It has its victim right there in its grasp. It's taking its paws and it's tearing that victim apart. And as it tears it apart, it has its mouth open because that mouth is eager, it's anxious to devour that victim. And Jesus looks out there at His enemies. And when He sees how eager, how anxious they are to take His life, He said, Father,
They are just like a lion with its mouth open, open. That is tearing its victim apart and roaring because it's so eager, it's so anxious to devour that victim. And as he saw the fierceness of his enemies and how they had cut off all possibility of escape, humanly speaking, as he saw how eager those enemies were to take his life, he said, "Father, my heart is melted like wax. My courage is gone. It's just disappeared altogether." And then notice the next thing that he mentions. He says that his strength was completely exhausted. Verse 15, he says, "My strength is dried up like a potsherd." A potsherd is a broken piece of pottery. And if that broken piece of pottery was exposed to the sun would take all the moisture in that broken piece of pottery and dry it up. So that that broken piece of pottery would become completely dry. And what Jesus is saying is just as the sun would dry up the moisture on a broken piece of pottery, so, Lord, my strength is dried up. My strength is completely gone. It's an awful thing to lose your strength. I remember one time I got a telephone call from my dad. His voice was quivering a little bit, so I knew something was wrong. And he said, "Son, Mother's very ill. She was in the hospital. She had had a stroke." He said, "She's lost all her strength. She can't pick up a fork to eat. She can't pick up a knife to cut her food. As light as a sheet is, she can't pull that sheet up over her. She can't even turn over. Her strength was gone." Now, praise the Lord, He brought her through that. She's still a total invalid. But the Lord did bring her through that. But it was an awful thing for her strength to be gone. And as Jesus hung there on Calvary's cross, He was suffering such intense pain. And I can just picture Jesus as He thought, "Well, maybe if I can just change my position slightly, it might ease that pain just a little bit." But then as He tried to change His position just a little bit, He didn't even have the strength to do that. And so He says, "Father, my strength is exhausted. Father, my strength is dried up like a potsherd." And then notice the next thing He mentions. He says that He was suffering an extreme thirst. The next part of verse 15 says, "And my tongue cleaveth to my jaws." In the Hebrew, it literally reads, "And my tongue is caused to cleave to my jaws." As Jesus suffered all that pain and misery, all the saliva in His mouth was dried up. His mouth became dry and parched, and His tongue just stuck to His jaws. And I can see our Savior hanging there. His mouth is so dry. His mouth is so parched, and He thinks, "If I just had something to moisten my lips just a little bit. If I had something just to wet my mouth just a little bit." And so He pauses as He talks to His Father. And He utters that fifth saying on the cross as He said, "I thirst." And when He said that, the Roman soldiers had a vessel with vinegar in it. And they took a sponge and they put it in the vinegar. And then they took a hyssop branch from the smallest of the trees in Palestine, and they put that sponge on it and they lifted it up to Jesus. And we're told that Jesus received the vinegar. Now when they tried to give Him wine mixed with myrrh to deaden the pain just before they nailed Him to the cross, Jesus refused that. He would go through everything that was necessary for our salvation. But when they offered Him the vinegar, we're told that He received it. And then after He said, "I thirst," He mentions the next thing as He continues to talk to His Father. And the next thing He says is that His hands and feet were pierced by His enemies. Look at verse 16.
The last part says, they pierced my hands and my feet. The word pierced literally means in the Hebrew to bore or to dig. And he says, my enemies have bored, they have dug my hands and my feet. Now I want you to see Jesus as he hangs there. As he looks out over his enemies, they've already reminded him of the bulls of Bashan because of their fierceness and the way they cut off all possibility of escape. They've already reminded him of a lion that is eager to devour his prey because of how eager they are to take his life. But now as he looks out there and casts his eyes about, those enemies remind him of another animal. And that is the dog. Look at the first part of verse 16. He says, for dogs have compassed me. And those dogs refer to those dogs that roam the streets of Palestine, those eastern savage dogs that everybody despised. And one thing that marked those dogs was this. They were as vicious as they could be. And what they would do would be to surround their victim again so that the victim couldn't escape. And then they would attack that victim. And as Jesus sees how they've cut off his escape, humanly speaking, and as he sees how vicious they have been in nailing him to an old rugged cross, he says, Father, dogs have compassed me. And they've manifested how vicious they are by piercing, by digging through, by boring my hands and my feet. Then notice what else he said in verse 16. He said, the assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. The word assembly is literally the word congregation. And the word wicked means evildoers. A congregation of evildoers. A gang of evildoers have surrounded me. He's talking about a gang of wicked people. And he said, just like they would surround a person to keep that person from escaping, so my enemies have put me here on the cross to keep me from escaping. And they have shown just how evil, how wicked they are by boring, by digging my hands and my feet. You would think with something as pointed as this, that there would be a verse somewhere in the New Testament that would say when those Roman soldiers took those spikes and drove them through the hands and the feet of Jesus, that they did it in order that this prediction might be fulfilled. But you don't have anything like that. But you have something else. Do you remember when Jesus rose from the dead? And he appeared to the disciples on that first Easter evening. There they were in the upper room of the house of John Mark's mother in Jerusalem. And when Jesus appeared, they thought he was a ghost. And so Jesus tried to prove to them that he had been bodily resurrected from the dead. And what is the first thing he did in order to prove to them his bodily resurrection? He appealed to their sense of sight and he said, behold my hands and my feet. Why did he want them to behold his hands? Why did he want them to behold his feet? Because they were marks of identification there. There were the nail prints there that he had received just 3 days ago when he was nailed to that old rugged cross. And even though Jesus had his resurrected, glorified body, those scars were still there in his hands and in his feet. And they'll remain there throughout all eternity as a constant reminder to you and to me of the tremendous price that Jesus had to pay to save your soul and to save my soul from the hell that we deserved. But notice the next thing he mentions. The next thing is that his emaciated body was made visible, so that he could count all of his bones if he desired. Look at verse 17. He says, I may count all my bones. You see that word count? The word count means to count accurately or to count exactly. And the force of the verb here denotes the possibility of this taking place. When Jesus was nailed to Calvary's cross,
They took his clothes from him. If he had anything on at all, it was something very brief about his waist. Because they wanted to expose Jesus, this Holy One, to as much shame as they possibly could. And so when Jesus was hanging there on that cross, the Holy, the spotless Son of God, he didn't have his clothes, hardly anything on. And as you looked at his body, you could see the bones protruding. He looked like a living skeleton. As Jesus hung there, he said, "Father, if I wanted to, I could look down and I could count every bone in my body." His emaciated body was made visible so that he could count all his bones if he desired. And then notice the next thing. He was looked upon with fiendish delight by his enemies. Look at the next part of verse 17. They. Now the word "they" doesn't refer to his bones. It refers to his enemies. They, referring to his enemies, look. Now watch it. "And stare upon me." You notice that word "stare"? Do you know what it means in the Hebrew? It means to look upon with exultation. It means to feast your eyes upon something. It means to gloat. I want you to see what the enemies were doing. As Jesus hung there on the cross, he was suffering such intense pain. The agony was unbearable. But his enemies just stood there. And they feasted their eyes upon him. The more he suffered, the wider their eyes became. The more he endured, the more they enjoyed it. And they gloated over him. You say, "Well, where is their compassion? Where is their pity?" There was no compassion. There was no pity. Where is that humane streak that is supposed to be in them? There was no humane streak. Because the more the Son of God suffered, the more his enemies enjoyed it. And as Jesus looked down and saw them and saw how they were enjoying his suffering, he says, "Father, they look and they stare with exultation, with fiendish delight upon me." And then notice the last thing that he mentioned. He said that his clothes were divided up among his enemies. And over one piece of clothes they gambled to determine who would receive it. Look at verse 18. "They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture." The Roman soldiers couldn't even wait until Jesus was dead. And this was something that was done purposefully. By taking the clothes of Jesus and dividing them up amongst themselves, and then gambling over his coat to see who would get it, because they didn't want to ruin it. It was all in one piece, and they knew if they tried to divide it up, they would ruin it. And so they decided to gamble to determine who would get it. By doing that, they were demonstrating to Jesus in the most graphic way possible that there was no escape for him. He was done. When you take somebody's clothes, that's it. A person will never need them again. Remember one time, one of my former students was teaching down at Jefferson Hospital. She was a nurse. And she contracted a fatal disease. And this disease attacked the muscles of her body, and she got so she couldn't talk. She had to write everything down. And my wife and I went to see her. She was a tremendous seamstress. She had made some beautiful clothes. And while we were there, she took a piece of paper and she wrote on it to my wife, "Go and try all my clothes." And so my wife did, and
They fit her beautifully. And then she wrote, I want you to take them. And I remember how the tears filled the eyes of my wife, and she looked at me, and I knew what she meant. She shook her head, indicating, I can't do that. If I take her clothes, it means it's all over. It means there's no hope of recovery. I can't do that. And so I said, Jane, I said, why don't we wait until a later time? It was just shortly after that that the Lord took Jane home to be with Himself. But when you take somebody's clothes, it means it's over, it's done. And that's what the Roman soldiers wanted Jesus to understand. We want you to know it's over, Jesus. It's done. You'll never wear these again. So we want you to see where they're going before you die. Because as far as you're concerned, you're through. You're finished. It's all over. As Jesus talks to His Father, He says, Father, they part my garments among them and cast lots for my vesture. Now here is something of what Jesus was suffering. Through the eyes of the crucified one. He was utterly helpless, poured out like water. He was suffering extreme physical pain. All his bones were out of joint. His courage was gone. His heart was like wax melted within him. His strength was completely exhausted, dried up like a potsherd. He was suffering extreme thirst. His tongue was caused to cleave to his jaws. His hands and feet had been pierced or bored by his enemies. They pierced my hands and my feet. His emaciated body was made visible so he could count all his bones if he desired. He says, I may count exactly all my bones. His enemies looked upon him with fiendish delight. He said, they look and stare upon me. And his clothes were divided up among his enemies, and over one of his garments they gambled to determine who would get it. But I want you to see quickly one more thing tonight, and that is the design of the suffering of the crucified one. Now, why did Jesus go through all of this? He did it for a very simple purpose. In order that He might take man who had been separated from God because of his sin and enable him to be reconciled to God. Turn over just for a moment to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. Notice what we read. The Apostle Peter says this, For Christ hath also once suffered for sin. You see that word suffered there? That word suffered in the Greek New Testament literally means to die. He says, For Christ also hath once died for or concerning sins. The just, now you see that word just, that's singular. The just one, Jesus was the only just one, the only perfect sinless one. The just one for, that is in place of and for the benefit of, the unjust. And the word unjust there is plural. That refers to you, folk. That refers to me. For Christ also hath once one time died for sins, the just one singular in place of and for the benefit of the just ones, plural. That's you. That would include me. That He might bring us to God. That He might reconcile us to God. And how did He do that? Being put to death, here it is, in the flesh. In that human nature, which Jesus took to Himself, consisting of a human body and a rational soul. Jesus was put to death. He suffered everything that we have seen tonight in order that He might take you and that He might take me, we who had been separated from God, and He might enable us to be reconciled to God, that we might have fellowship with Him once again. Now let me ask you something, folk. Do you think for a moment that God would have let His Son, whom He loved so much, endure all that we have seen tonight? If it were not necessary to save our souls from hell? Oh no. God loved His Son too much for that.
God knew that what Jesus suffered was absolutely necessary to save our souls from hell. That's why He suffered everything that we have seen tonight. He bore, now listen, the equivalent of what you and I would have to suffer in hell if we were to go there. He bore that in that human nature that He took to Himself, that He might satisfy the demand of the law upon us, which said that we must suffer an eternal punishment in hell for this sin, that law might be satisfied, that the penalty might be paid, so that I might escape that punishment, God might righteously forgive me and enable me to be reconciled to Him, enable me to have fellowship with Him.
Now let me ask you something, folks. Do you think for a moment that God would have let His Son, whom He loves so much, endure all that we have seen tonight if it were not necessary to save our souls from hell? Oh no. God loved His Son too much for that.
God knew that what Jesus suffered was absolutely necessary to save our souls from hell. That's why He suffered everything that we have seen tonight. He bore, now listen, the equivalent of what you and I would have to suffer in hell if we were to go there. He bore that in that human nature that He took to Himself, that He might satisfy the demand of the law upon us, which said that we must suffer eternal punishment in hell for this sin, that law might be satisfied, that the penalty might be paid, so that I might escape that punishment, God might righteously forgive me and enable me to be reconciled to Him, enable me to have fellowship with Him. And folk, if there was any other way, now put it down, if there was any other way that we could be saved apart from trusting Jesus, God would never have allowed His Son to endure all this. You see, there is no other way. The way of the cross leads home. That's the only way. And unless you and I come that way, we'll never be saved. One evening in Passaic, New Jersey, trains were bringing hundreds of people home from New York to their homes. There was a switch house there that overlooked the tracks. And there was a man in the switch house, and his task was to pull the lever that would send the trains over the bridge that spanned the river there. A train was approaching. The man in the switch house put his hand on the lever and he was about to pull it. He looked down at the bridge and he saw a little boy walking across that bridge. He looked a little more closely and he saw that that little boy was his son. He only had a few seconds to make the decision. He knew that if he pulled that lever, his son would be ground to death beneath the wheels of that train. He knew that if he didn't pull the lever, the hundreds of people on board that train would be killed. He did the only thing he could. He pulled the lever. And that train went across that bridge, and that man watched as his son was ground to death beneath the wheels of that train. But the hundreds on board were saved because of it. I say this respectfully, folk. God looked down and He saw that unless He gave His son, you and I would not just suffer physical death. We would suffer eternal death in hell itself. God pulled the lever. He sent His Son down to this earth that He might be ground to death on an old rugged cross, that if you and I believe in Him, we might be saved.
I'm so glad Jesus did that for me. Aren't you?